The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We had a great time last week talking with Marcella Wojcik about foot anomalies. And to be honest, we had intended to talk about leg anomalies last week too, but there's just so much stuff there that we wanted to make sure to devote adequate time to that. So this week, we're going to talk about leg anomalies. Welcome back to the podcast, Marcella Wojcik.
Thanks, Paul, for having me.
So have you developed any conflicts over the week that we should talk about?
I have not.
Okay. So we're going to take sort of the same tack this week, and as we've talked about both a little bit last week as well as offline, we both get asked a lot of questions about leg issues. Some of them worrisome, some of them less worrisome, but we get asked about them because somebody is worried about them, whether the parents or the grandparents, and we try to navigate what we should have worries about. So let's talk about this. We touched briefly last week on the fact that we expect a normal sequence in leg development. You want to just revisit that quickly?
Sure. So I think there's different things that we break this up into. And one of the things that I think, Paul, you mentioned was to talk about bow legs and knock knees. And I think of that in the orthopedic realm as a coronal plane abnormality. So kids with bow legs can have physiologic bowing or physiologic genuvarum until they're about 18 to 24 months of age. So hopefully by the age of two, the bow legs is starting to straighten out a little bit. And I, again, think a lot of this is variable. I try to talk to families about, you know, most of us fall like within the bell-shaped curve. But then there's some kids that are the outliers. And then even in a family, one child may be bow-legged and another child may never have had that happen. But it's typical for legs to be a little bit bowed until around two. And then somewhere between around two and three, legs start to get a little straighter, but then they can swing into genuvalgum. And knock knees can be pretty aggressive too. There's a big spectrum of that. Kids can have up to 15, 20 degrees of knock knees. And even as bad as that looks, especially with how they walk and run, where their knees kind of run together and kids kind of swing their legs out in this like circumduction gait pattern, even that corrects. And again, that's just physiologic genuvalgum. And I think like the worst age that I see that in is roughly the age of four. So somewhere between three and five, roughly four, kids look maximally knock-kneed. And then I tell parents that usually by the time your kid's going to school, like kindergarten, first grade, your knock-knees should be going away. And they should be getting straighter. So the child should really have pretty normal alignment by roughly the age of eight. Obviously, there's some wiggle room in terms of growth, but by 8 or 10 years of age, you kind of are who you're probably going to be as an adult. And we say that as an adult, you should be about 6 degrees of valgus at your knee, but you should be effectively straight. The 6 degrees is pretty minor, but that's normal for varus and valgus. And then we also look at kids from a rotational perspective. And we talked a little bit earlier about tibial torsion. So a lot of kids will have inward or internal tibial torsion. And that can be when you're an infant, a toddler. But really by the time you're roughly eight, you should have a little bit more outward tibial torsion. And that should be about 10, 15, 20 degrees at the most, so that your feet are pointed a little bit out and you're not tripping over your feet when you walk. So if we think about doing anything to address the tibial torsion, we typically think doing something for that maybe over the age of eight. But then attached to your upper leg is your femur bone, and those guys can have antiversion or they can have retroversion. So antiversion is usually what kids are born with. So they have usually about 45 degrees of antiversion. And to me, what that looks like on an exam is kids sit like a W. So their legs are off to the side. And the W sitting is something that I feel like I see a little bit more in girls than boys, but your antiversion decreases until you're at least roughly 10, but there's even some decrease in your upper femur angle until you're 14 or 16. But the angle decreases so that you go from being an inwardly rotated person to more of an outwardly rotated person. So I think of somebody being a little bit more normal on the spectrum as 10, 11, 12 years of age with inward rotation that's maybe 30 or 40 degrees, but outward rotation of more like 60 degrees. And again, that's just so that your feet point out when you walk and you're not tripping over your own feet all the time. And that's kind of normal for tibial torsion and femoral antiversion. But there's obviously a little bit of a spectrum, and this is for kids who are developmentally normal. If I meet somebody who has cerebral palsy or an underlying neuromuscular condition, those numbers don't necessarily apply, and they can do things differently based on their spasticity and their muscle control.
Let me ask you a couple of questions that people seem to talk about, I think, more in the past than now. Does W sitting cause femoral antiversion, or does femoral antiversion allow W sitting?
Femoral antiversion allows W sitting. So I tell parents consistently, it's really okay if your kid sits like that. And I let them know that their teacher or grandmother or physical therapist, like, don't need to harp on it. It's really okay.
And the pediatrician who told them that meant well,
yes.
but knowledge has advanced since then.
Yeah. So your bone has a certain shape and you're born with it, and it gets better with time and growth. And it lessens, and then you're not able to do it as much. But, you know, some of it is flexibility, but most of it is bone shape. And you're not going to change it by not sitting like a W. It's just going to change over time the way it's supposed to.
Going back to the issue of bowed legs, at what point should I worry about that? So there are some conditions that can cause abnormal bowed legs. When should I send those kids to you? So we talked about, you know, expecting best alignment by second or third grade, but when should I be worried in the younger kids?
Yeah, so I think if it's bow legs, that's, you know, really beyond the age of probably three, what I think that's even a good starting point. I think it's worth seeing a patient and probably getting an x-ray and looking at their knee, because sometimes they have the diagnosis of Blount's syndrome, Blount's disease, and that's an abnormality at the proximal medial tibial growth plate. And we don't see that as much in Utah as I did even in my residency program in Milwaukee. And we see it a little bit more in heavy set kids, kids who walk early. We see it more in a Black population, but you know, you could see findings on an x-ray as early as three. And even if you see a little bit of beaking, you might watch it for a little bit of time and just maybe they're on the older age of spectrum where they're going to correct it. But I think following those kids is important. So I think if you meet a child in your office that's three, definitely four, I'd send him for an evaluation where we can take a picture and watch along. And then, you know, if I had a six-year-old, an eight-year-old with bowing genuvarum, then we typically look for the pathologic causes. So, and that can be related to so many different things. It could be that they had a fracture, they had an infection, they have a benign bone tumor potentially that's leading to bow legs. They could have the Blount's disease. There's a whole host of things that we think of that we need to assess for to see why they're varus. Our rule in orthopedics for pretty much everything is thou shalt not varus. We don't really like people to be bowed. And that's at their hips, their knees, and their ankles. So if you have a child over three, I'd say it's worthwhile to have them evaluated. Knock knees, I think, you know, are a little, they're pretty common, and we don't always see kids with that. You know, sometimes I see knock knees in heavier set kids, but I also see them in really tall, skinny kids. And then I see them in families. So some families just know to have their kids' alignment checked because two of their other kids have it. But I think over the age of 8 or 10 with knock knees, it's worth an assessment with an x-ray. The one thing I do get asked about a lot from parents or told is that they were told the knock knees would go away. And they were also then secondarily told, don't go get a checkup for it until you're done growing, which I would raise my hand and say, we have a really great way to treat knock knees and bow legs when you're growing with a really simple procedure called guided growth versus an osteotomy where we have to cut the bone. The recovery from the guided growth is way quicker and doesn't really interrupt your life as much as some of the bigger things when you're done growing.
Can you describe briefly what guided growth entails?
Yeah. One of my mentors, Dr. Stevens, he developed an 8 plate, which looks like the figure of 8, and it's a tension band device designed to help make the growth plate grow in a certain direction. Prior to that, there's a guy named William Blount, who is actually from where I trained in Milwaukee, who designed these Blount staples. But guided growth in general is making a very small incision, often on the knee, but it can be used in other places in the body. And you put it on one part of the growth plate, and it behaves where it compresses the growth plate on one side and it tells the other side to grow in tension, which is an orthopedic principle we like to quiz residents about. But it corrects the alignment roughly in a year. And kids can walk with that plate in, and they can run, play sports, play football. It's really straightforward, and it has a lot of utility in growing kids. So if you have knock knees or bow legs and you're still growing, and it seems like outside of the realm of physiologic varus or valgus, by all means, let us take a look at them. We have a great way to take standing long leg x-rays in our office, which can measure somebody's alignment. And if guided growth is an option, I think it's a really nice option for a lot of kids.
I heard Dr. Stevens talk about this once, and I was just fascinated by the fact that what this means is that, for one thing, that there's a very simple way to do this. I mean, because an osteotomy is, correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't do surgery, but an osteotomy seems like a polite way of saying kind of sawing your bone off and moving it into the right position.
Yeah. I mean, it's breaking your bone gently. And,
breaking your bone gently. That's only an orthopedic surgeon can say that.
Yeah. You know, an osteotomy is a big deal. There's more risk. There's more potential cause for concern to damage a nerve or a blood vessel, but the recovery is vastly different. Guided growth, you can walk typically the same day. You might want crutches for a day or two, but an osteotomy means you're probably not walking on that limb for a minimum of 6 to 12 weeks, and then you're going to need some physical therapy and some rehab. But guided growth is really pretty fast intervention, outpatient surgery, and it's a great option for our kids.
And the other point that he made that was fascinating to me is that there is this normal developmental sequence for what happens with the shape of bones. And that the great thing about being you guys and knowing how that plays out, because he said, if you correct a bone at the wrong point, then the body may continue in the direction it was headed. And now you've caused a problem. And so that's why the collaboration is so important.
Yeah. And I think some of it is also really important to think about the patient's age and where they are in that developmental spectrum, because you could certainly correct something and then your body decides to correct it the way it's supposed to, and then you're going in the total wrong direction. So having that understanding is really important.
You just double corrected. The point that you made too is that this is all predicated on the fact that you're cooperating with a growing organism. And so that's the main reason why we definitely want to catch someone at a point where there's still growth that you can correct.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing. Talk to me about limb length discrepancy.
Yeah, so limb length discrepancy, I think, is something I see a lot of. And I'm sometimes fascinated when pediatricians pick it up, because sometimes I don't see it. It's so minor. But I'll have kids who just come in for a screening because their pediatrician recognized that like the pelvis was a little bit off or something like that. But I often have the distinct pleasure of telling parents that their child has a leg length difference that's really mild and typical. Around a centimeter is kind of normal for many of us. So 10 millimeters of difference is not an unusual thing. We have no real idea as to why the difference exists between your legs, but 10 millimeters is kind of an average normal. I imagine if I got an x-ray of my legs, I'd probably have one, but I've never done it. But I see kids at least probably once or twice a week that have that limb length difference. And it's not because they had a broken bone and it grew longer or shorter or something like that. It's just part of them. For the vast majority of kids, if not all, a 1 centimeter leg length difference doesn't usually correspond to any noticeable pain, disability, dysfunction, or even recognition that they have it. So if they don't notice it, and I barely notice it, but an x-ray tells me the exact number and it's around a centimeter or maybe 1.5 centimeters, I tend to ignore it. As you get a little closer to the 2 centimeter, 2.5 centimeter or inch range, then we start thinking about treating it. We have really poor data out there that talks about what does a leg length difference do when you're an adult. But the studies that I think initially happened in Britain said that if you had at least around an inch of a leg length difference, you were going to have trouble as an adult, meaning back pain, hip pain, knee pain. And so I think for most of those patients, if you see somebody with closer to 2 centimeters or an inch of a leg length difference, we usually recommend treatment. And the types of treatment really depend on the age of the patient, what the reason is for the leg length difference, what the expected difference is when you're going to be done growing, and, you know, any other underlying diagnoses. So, and there's like huge variability in that. I think I could probably come up with 5 or 10 things pretty easily and say that it's different for every kid. You know, if you have a sizable limb length difference, like I'm thinking about, does the patient have cerebral palsy where they have one side that's shorter or smaller? Do they have hemihypertrophy or hemiatrophy? Do they have a tumor that's causing a limb length difference? And all of those patients, I think we just have to be deliberate about assessing the entire patient, not just the leg length difference. And if it's a minor leg length difference, You know, we might recommend a foot orthotic. We might recommend a shoe lift on the outside of the shoe. And then at some point, we might recommend a shortening or a lengthening procedure. And some of those are minor, where we use the guided growth technique, where we can help shorten a long leg with those plates and screws we talked about. And then sometimes we have to like cut the bone and take a piece out or make it grow longer. And again, all of that depends on like who the patient is and what their diagnosis is.
If you find that somebody has a minor leg length discrepancy, does that tend to change over time as the child grows?
So typically, no. If it's a centimeter, 1 centimeter, 12 millimeters, it usually doesn't. I find that over my career, it's often easier to see a child back, at least for like a separate visit, once I have a baseline x-ray of, oh, yes, you have a leg length difference of a centimeter. If that's why the patient came to see me, is for the leg length difference and the concern about it, then I'll probably have them come back 6 months, maybe a year later, and prove that it's staying the same. But if somebody has an underlying reason for the leg length difference, that could definitely change. And it really just depends on what that diagnosis is. If you're born with something that is going to lead to a leg length difference, it usually remains a percentage of difference from the other side. But if you develop an infection like a septic arthritis or an osteomyelitis, or you have a fracture that hurts your growth plate, those kids have not really well-defined growth from their growth plate. And so those kids will need probably closer follow-up.
Okay. Let's try to tackle something that we deal with a lot. And this will spill over, I think, a little bit to next week's discussion about limping. Can we talk a little bit about leg pain? Because we hear a
sure.
lot about leg pain.
Yeah.
I'm sure you hear a lot about leg pain.
I do.
We want you to define absolutely definitively for us what growing pains are by the end of the session.
Sure.
But short of that, do you want to talk about some of the causes of leg pain?
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely see kids that we describe as having growing pains. And for me, what that looks like is usually a family tells me that their kid is having pain maybe at the end of the day, maybe after a super active day, and usually at night. And sometimes it might wake them up at night, or it might make it difficult for them to go to sleep, but it's pretty vague. It's like my thighs hurt, my knees hurt, one knee hurts, one thigh hurts, one calf hurts, one foot hurts. It's super vague and nonspecific. And parents will often tell me, I gave my child some ibuprofen, or I did some massage and it got better. And then they woke up the next day and they're running around like crazy and they're fine. And that's kind of who I think has growing pains.
Mm-hmm.
The things that raise suspicion in my world are I wake up with ankle pain or knee pain and it hurts me every morning. And then I'm starting to worry about, is this a rheumatologic process that I should be thinking about? Is it activity related where every time they do a certain sport, are they making some part of their limb hurt? And maybe that's an overuse type syndrome. Or something else. But I think like the growing pains are like the super vague things that you hear about probably every day in your life. And I think for me, one thing that I will say to parents with some frequency is, you know, if your kid is running, jumping, playing, and just like being their typical self, they're not avoiding activities, taking themselves out of an activity, but they have this complaint of pain with some frequency and it might wax and wane, then I'm usually okay kind of watching that and trying to ignore it or ask the family to ignore it. I do think that it varies in families. Like some kids will have growing pains and then like another sibling won't have them at all. And I don't know if I can explain that. I think now wonder maybe is vitamin D have some role in growing pains. And I think a huge percentage of our population is low on vitamin D. So in addition to maybe ibuprofen, I might recommend some additional vitamin D to a patient who's having a lot of growing pains. But for a patient where it just seems to kind of come and go, it's a little bit cyclical, but in general, they're like a typical kid that's really active, then I'm chalking it up to growing pains, but I don't necessarily know the exact answer either.
As somebody who understands bones much better than I ever possibly could, does growing hurt, do you think?
I think it does. But I also think it does happen at night. Like my patients with broken bones are kind of a good example of that. When kids break a bone, whether it's an arm or a leg, at nighttime, they say that like it hurts. And part of that, I think, is, well, during the day, they're distracted and they've got their Switch or their video game or their sport to think about. But at nighttime, I do think that there's some growing that can happen. And I do think that that can contribute to some pain. I don't know that we understand the process of it, but I also tell families, like, I don't necessarily mind the growing pains because then your kid's growing and that's good.
The good news, I think the point that you can reassure them on is if your child looks great in the morning, then that's probably something to trust.
Yeah.
Well, Marcella, thank you so much. Again, this has been very, very enlightening. Next week, we're going to completely understand what to do when a child comes limping into the office. And so we will limp out from this session. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@thecurb.com, and we'll address those in a couple of weeks. Marcella, thanks for your time. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.